every time. We only have 20 seconds. Can you respond to this?
Well, what's interesting about Judge Kaczynski's dissent is that he was seeking to engage in a discussion about how we carry out executions. And so it's ironic that he wrote that as a dissent to an opinion that the Arizona Department of Corrections ought to disclose additional information, given that he wanted to engage in discourse.
Megan McCracken, thank you for spending this time with us, attorney with the UC Berkeley School of Law's Death Penalty Clinic. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is hiring. We have an opening for an on-air graphic designer. Go to democracynow.org for details. I'll be speaking at Martha's Vineyard Saturday night, July 26th at 7 o'clock. Check out the details at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland, and now time for the evening news.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO wants you. Yes, you. Are you excited about the new possibilities for local independent media? Are you ready to help KBOO reach out and grow stronger in the community? We're looking for candidates for KBOO's board of directors, and we've extended our search through July 31st. So if you'd like to share your skills with the people who share your values, download a copy of our board candidate package at kboo.fm. Or you can pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. July 31st, so don't delay. And we look forward to seeing more of you at KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
We're unaccompanied immigrant children who arrived in Portland on Tuesday.
Portland City Council has approved a measure that sends a park bond measure to the voters in November.
And the Israeli ground invasion of Gaza continues, with over 100 Palestinians killed on Thursday alone.
Good evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 24th, 2014. I'm Henry Leisha.
I'm Robert Barncord. In the latest news from the Israeli assault on Gaza, which reached the two-week point today, at least 100 Palestinians have been killed, including 17 who were killed in a bomb dropped on a United Nations school which had been serving as a shelter. The civilians who were sheltering in the school had received no prior warning before the airstrike. In addition to killing 17 people, an estimated 200 were wounded, mainly small children and their mothers. A spokesperson for the United Nations in Gaza said that the Israeli military knew the location of the school because they had been given the exact coordinates several times. Three teachers working for the UN agency were killed, marking the first casualties among United Nations workers. An eyewitness was quoted by local radio as saying that, immediately before the shelling, a man, introducing himself as a Red Cross official, was asking people to gather in the yard because they were going to be evacuated to a different shelter. But a United Nations official who saw people gathering asserted that there had been no evacuation order and told the people to go back into their rooms. During the argument which ensued, Israeli artillery shells began bombarding the school. Abu Hassana said that the majority of the displaced people sheltering at the school were elderly people, women, and children. And in southern Gaza, dozens of bodies were retrieved from the rubble of Qaza village, which was hit hard by an Israeli assault last night. In the West Bank, tens of thousands of Palestinians held a protest march in the evening and attempted to march on Jerusalem. The march was organized by nonviolent coordinating committees across the West Bank and focused on solidarity with Gaza. It resulted in a clash with Israeli police at the Qalandia checkpoint Thursday evening. The protesters, chanting "Gaza is our star in the sky," which refers to the fact that Palestinians in the West Bank are forbidden from traveling to Gaza. Israel has laws preventing Palestinians from traveling through Israeli-controlled territory and has set up a massive wall and checkpoints to stop Palestinians from traveling. Eyewitnesses reported seeing at least four Israeli snipers on rooftops, and there are reports of live ammunition being used against the demonstrators. There are reports of two killed and a number of injuries, but the exact number is unknown at this point. Israeli forces, who control all movements in the West Bank, have put in place a full closure since the Israeli attack on Gaza began on July 8th. This prevents Palestinians from accessing Jerusalem. This includes preventing access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque for Friday prayers during the holy month of Ramadan, which began on June 28th and will go on until July 24th this year. At the beginning of the Israeli offensive in Gaza, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a statement that Israel will, quote, make the month of Ramadan a month of darkness and pain for the people of Gaza. We will have more on the Israeli invasion of Gaza at 5:45 today, including analysis of the U.S. role in providing Israel with billions of dollars in military and financial aid. Israel is the single largest recipient of United States foreign aid.
Yesterday, an Arizona inmate was left gasping and snorting for nearly 2 hours before his execution was finished. Joseph Wood was alive for 117 minutes after he received a lethal injection that was supposed to kill him quietly and peacefully. Wood's lawyers had fought to postpone the execution until the state of Arizona revealed more information about the untested combination of deadly drugs they planned to use. Since the execution, the defense has criticized the state for the secrecy it maintained about the manufacturer and the combination of drugs. Joseph Wood was convicted of killing his girlfriend Deborah Dietz and her father in 1989. When asked about the execution, Arizona Governor Jan Brewer stated that Wood didn't suffer in comparison to his victims.
The 71-year-old Reedsport man shot by police last week has died from his injuries. The police say they responded to a report of a verbal and physical disturbance at a mobile home park where the elderly resident Glenn Ray Glancy confronted them with a handgun. Reedsport police say shots were exchanged. Glancy was shot, quote, at least once, and he was taken to the Lower Umpqua Hospital for initial treatment. He died there 3 days later. The names of the involved officers are being withheld, and no one else was injured during the incident. Both deputies from Douglas County Sheriff's Office and one Reedsport police officer are on paid administrative leave, which is standard protocol during officer-involved shooting investigations.
Portland City Council unanimously approved the 2014 Parks Replacement Bond in a special session this afternoon. The measure maintains the current level of taxes set to expire this year. The bond authorizes approximately $68 million in funds to improve playgrounds, trails, facilities, accessibility, and safety.
We had looked a year ago at could we do a bigger bond measure, and as I've been talking with folks all over the city the past couple of months, I've had several comments, and one of the first is usually, why don't you ask for more? And the answer is because people can't afford to pay for more right now. And we're questioning whether indeed they'll be able to pay what we're asking right now. Some other people say, well, why don't you let it go for a once and let's have taxes go down. Well, yes, we could let the taxes go down by $13 a year. But just think what we could get if we all pay $13 a year, then we get to up to 68 million without changing the tax rate. And that's the opportunity that we have now. We have a lot of work to do between now and November. Most bond measure campaigns start a year or more ahead of time and have much more public process to look at what should be on the list, on the project list. we didn't need to do so much process to identify the first project list, because we know what's broken and we know what's just about to break. And so there isn't a question. The question will be actually in the second part, where we're still going to have a lot of needs that we know are just about to break or have already broken, and we won't be able to have enough money to pay for all of those. And so that's where we will need much more community engagement to look at that second list when we do the second round of issuance of the bond. The way it works is that next year, if it passes, we will bond for the first part of the money. We then have 3 years to continue to complete those projects, and then we bond for the second half and do those within another 3 years. And then for the remaining 14 years of the bond measure, we pay off for the projects that we've done. But it's a way of making sure that we do keep pools open, that we keep playgrounds open, that we reopen trails that have closed, that we look at taking care of what we have in the way that we have always done that. And if there's ever a bureau, we have many great bureaus and many city staff who work night and day to provide services for Portland that make it such a great place. And we have citizens like you who take the time to come on a Thursday afternoon to take your 3 minutes to add your piece. And I greatly appreciate that, because we are all in this together. And this bond measure has been a long time coming. It's not the same as Mayor Hales's, then Commissioner Hales's in 1994, which got 194 shiny new projects, including two community centers and a bunch of new playgrounds and more goodies than I can remember. That's not what this one is. This one is basic services. And I ran in 2008 and then again in 2012 to provide basic services to Portland citizens, and to do it by spending taxpayers' money wisely. And the Parks Bureau does spend the taxpayers' money wisely. We do more with less, and we have a history of doing this. This is the way we have funded parks over the past 100 years, is to pass levies and bond measures for improvements. And we now have the added benefit of system development charges, which are how new construction pays its way and new development pays its way. But those funds can't be used for basic maintenance. And so Linda Robertson is right that we have allocated many of those funds in the last year to East Portland and other areas that have been deficient, and which are looking for, in 20 years' time, perhaps another replacement bond measure to continue providing the piece of the puzzle. This isn't going to provide all of it, and that was well illustrated in the presentation. So we need to continue the discussion, and as Lightning said, we need to look at all of the needs within the system, with transportation and with housing and with the rest of what's needed in parks, because this doesn't fix the whole thing.
We'll go through a vote. The Parks Bond will go through a vote in the November 4th general election.
Housing activists yesterday called on the Portland City Council to use its new tax on short-term rentals to go entirely towards affordable housing. The multiracial coalition of activists includes the Native American Youth Association, the Portland African American Leadership Forum, Street Roots, Hacienda CDC, Verde, Opal, Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, and more. The City Council of Portland has already discussed using the proposed tax on Airbnb as a dedicated stream of funding for affordable housing. The activists say that while the revenue that would be generated from this fee is in no way sufficient to address Portland's daunting shortage of affordable housing, it would set an important precedent and pave the way for further, more substantial investments. Currently, Portland is short by thousands of affordable housing units, and thousands more Portlanders have no shelter at all. Meanwhile, rents on the open market are skyrocketing. Activists say that the growth of short-term rentals, such as Airbnb, has displaced poor families in other cities and might be doing the same right here in Portland.
On Tuesday, around 90 unaccompanied immigrant children arrived in Portland, where they will be housed as immigration authorities try to locate their families and determine whether they can remain in the country. They will be under the care of Morrison Child and Family Services, which received $3.6 million in grants from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services this year for the express purpose of providing safe and secure housing for unaccompanied immigrant children. Both Morrison and the federal government have kept quiet about the deal and its specifics, ostensibly for the safety of the children. The children were all picked up at the U.S.-Mexico border, most of them having made the journey from Central America. The increasing numbers of Central American children fleeing to the U.S. is a result of intensifying drug violence and crushing poverty in their home countries. In a number of U.S. towns closer to the border, busloads of immigrants have been met with angry protests from anti-immigration activists, which have on occasion forced the buses to be rerouted to larger cities where processing centers are already overwhelmed. To prevent such a reception from occurring in Portland, a number of organizations, including Jobs with Justice, Portland Central America Solidarity Committee, and many others, held a rally downtown to welcome the children, holding signs reading Bienvenidos and Welcome Refugee Children. For more on the rally and Portland's role in the ongoing immigration debate, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Marco Mejia of Jobs with Justice.
Are the children being brought here to be processed or detained?
Yeah, so what I understand is that these children that are coming here are the ones that have been detained at the border, trying to pass or cross the border to the United States. In this case, these kids are in the custody of the government. So they are not technically detained. That's what I understand. So they will come here, and then they will be, or are, and I'm saying that because we don't have any precise information, because the government and the agency that is holding the, housing them here don't want all of this information to be out to public for security of the kids.
Has there been any major anti-immigration demonstrations or threats made against them since they've arrived here?
Well, in Portland, and I'm not very sure in the rest of the Oregon, but in Portland there was a demonstration last week on Friday, which the anti-immigrant and hate group called Oregonians for Immigration Reform organized a demonstration in front of the Mexican consulate, which, by the way, most of the kids are not Mexican. They are especially from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador.
So you were part of a coalition of groups that held a sort of a rally downtown on Tuesday when the kids arrived in town. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Yeah, so a number of people and groups and organizations in the community have been concerned about this issue, and we got together and we decided to, we knew already that there were kids that were coming here to Oregon. And as we know also in the news, there has been some of these hate demonstrations of these hate groups in other places. So we wanted to really present a welcoming environment for these kids, and especially to also make the point that people in the United States need to understand that these are refugee kids, and that they need to understand the reasons why they're coming here. They're using these groups, anti-immigrant groups, using these kids for, as I said, you know, these ends of creating more hate and xenophobia here. So we just wanted to show that here in Portland, we don't allow that, and that actually we are a welcoming city for refugees, for immigrants, and for everyone. Throughout the day, they didn't show up. I'm referring to these anti-immigrant groups. They didn't come out on Tuesday. But we had, I will say, more than 100 people coming out to be very supportive and in solidarity with the kids. We were at the corner of Southwest 10th, Jefferson, I think. Oh, no, Salmon. And it was just a corner in downtown that we picked to be present in downtown and give our message out. And as I said, you know, we had a lot of people coming through from 11 to 5 p.m. and pretty much covering all the corners there. So there was a lot of support from the people that came by, from cars. Most of the people were supportive. They know about what's going on, and they were supporting these kids.
What's in store for these kids now? What further process are they going through?
So what I understand is that these kids are coming here, and as you mentioned also, the Morrison Center will house them. But the process is that they will try to do a number of things. There's kids that have some relatives or parents that are in the United States, so I think that they will try to identify where they are and to connect the kids with them. For the ones that are not having any relatives, they will go through the immigration process. They need to know if they could be and qualify for refugee status, because once they have a status as a refugee, they can go through the normal immigration process in order to be, if you want to call it, you know, legally here in the United States, and they will, you know, have the help that they need as children.
Marco, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you very much, too.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Marco Mejia of Jobs with Justice.
A federal appeals court today ruled that Chiquita Brand International does not have to pay damages to relatives of thousands of Colombians killed during years of bloody civil war. The lawsuits say that Chiquita paid $1.7 million to a violent right-wing paramilitary group known as the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, propping up the group's death squads. Chiquita, formerly known as the United Fruit Company, owned vast banana plantations in Colombia and claimed in court that Chiquita, was the victim of extortion from the paramilitary group. A 2-1 majority on the federal appeals court ruled against the death squad survivors based on a 2013 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that imposed limits on foreign people using United States courts to seek damages against corporations for human rights abuses abroad. In 1998, the Cincinnati Enquirer published an 18-page expose of Chiquita's dealings in Latin America. The paper found that Chiquita exposed entire communities to dangerous pesticides that were banned in the U.S. They forced the eviction of an entire Honduran village at gunpoint. They had suppressed unions, and they had spent large sums to influence trade policy decisions made by United States politicians. The Enquirer was later forced to issue a front-page apology and pay Chiquita a reported $14 million after it was revealed that the lead reporter, Mike Gallagher, illegally accessed more than 2,000 Chiquita voicemails. While the reporter admitted to accessing the mails, the information in that series was not found to be inaccurate.
A report issued by the U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations says that certain banks' hedge funds created a, quote, alternate universe of financial transactions that allowed the hedge funds to dodge higher tax rates. Renaissance Technologies, a Long Island hedge fund, may have avoided as much as $6.8 billion in taxes. Between 2000 and 2013, the report says certain banks offered complex, so-called basket options to select hedge funds, essentially allowing them to make thousands of rapid trades within the bank accounts and cash in at the end of 1 year. By doing this, the funds made massive short-term capital gains, but paid the lower tax rate for long-term capital gains. The report was authored by Democrat Carl Levin and Republican John McCain, and the subcommittee questioned executives with Renaissance and the banks Deutsche and Barclays on Tuesday. The subcommittee has so far avoided declaring any of these financial maneuverings illegal. Renaissance Technologies is also a political actor in Oregon. Robert Mercer, the CEO of Renaissance, has funneled hundreds of thousands of dollars via a super PAC into campaigns to defeat Democratic Congressman Peter DeFazio in 2010 and 2012. DeFazio has proposed a tax on individual trades, which would put a considerable damper on the business practices used by Renaissance and other Wall Street firms, which make hundreds of thousands of trades every week.
A draft chapter of a trade agreement between the United States of America and the European Union reveals that public health could be at risk. The chapter was leaked today by the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. It raises concerns over food safety as well as animal and plant health in the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership negotiations. Its acronym is TTIP. The chapter indicates that TTIP negotiators have been maximizing trade at the expense of regulations. The text supports how the United States does not require port of entry food inspections and testing. This makes it difficult to trace the origins of contamination outbreaks and determine who is liable. The text also indicates that the trade agreement could make it difficult to impose trade restrictions on countries with plant and animal diseases. So far, TTIP negotiations are still in the works. The EU and the U.S. trade negotiators finished their sixth round of week-long talks in Brussels, Belgium, on July 18th.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Allison Weir of If Americans Knew about the ongoing Israeli attack on Gaza, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 78 and a low of 55. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 32 counts per minute in North Portland, 27 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington, Eugene, Oregon has a count of 30 CPM, Hanford, Washington has a count of 36 CPM, and North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current radiation count of 32 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. Radcast alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, for Pontchartrain du Detroit was established in 1701, later growing into the city of Detroit, and in 1847, Brigham Young led Mormon settlers into the Salt Lake Valley after 17 months of travel, establishing Salt Lake City. The quote of the day is from Amelia Earhart, born on this day in 1897. Never interrupt somebody doing something you said couldn't be done.
Excellent news, people. Let me put it to you as a number. 8.7 million. That's how many new jobs the American economy has generated since the Great Recession officially ended in 2009.
Okay.
And it also happens to be the number of jobs that were lost because of that recession. Don't you see? You can break out the champagne, for the American economy is back, baby. All of the lost jobs have been recovered. What? You say you don't feel recovered? Well, it's true that the U.S. population has kept growing since the crash, so about 15 million more working-age people have entered the job market, meaning America still has millions more people looking for work than it has jobs. And it's true that long-term unemployment is a growing crisis, especially for middle-aged job seekers who've gone one, two, or more years without even getting an interview, much less an offer. So they've dropped out of the market and are not counted as unemployed. Also, millions of young people are squeezed out of this so-called recovery. The effective unemployment rate for 18 to 29-year-olds is above 15%, more than double the national rate of 6.3%. But take heart, people, for economists are telling us that full employment may be right around the corner. Is that because Congress is finally going to pass a national jobs program to get America working again? Or could it be that corporate chieftains are going to bring home some of the trillions of dollars they've stashed in offshore tax havens to invest in new products and other job-creating initiatives right here in the USA? This is Jim Hightower saying, no, no, don't be silly. Economists are upbeat because they've decided to redefine full employment by hocus-pocus, simply declaring that having 6% of our people out of work is acceptable as the new normal. Wow, and you thought American ingenuity was dead.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The Scanner News reports today that Seattle Mayor Ed Murray has set an historic precedent by instructing city law enforcement to, quote, stand down from evicting a stroke-afflicted Vietnam veteran from his underwater West Seattle home. The Occupy-related group Standing Against Foreclosure and Eviction and the Washington Community Action Network had spent weeks of focused organizing in support of the elderly homeowners, Byron and John Barton. Byron Barton, a Vietnam veteran, had suffered a stroke that left him unable to walk and with a severe speech disability. The couple fell behind in their mortgage. The deed for their home was bought at auction by Quality Loan Service, who sold it to Triangle Property Development, who foreclosed on the couple and filed for the eviction. Quality Loan Service settled this spring with the state attorney general over charges of unfair and unjust business practices. The Bartons are currently suing Quality Loan Service, as well as J.P. Morgan Chase, and had asked Triangle to suspend the foreclosure while the case remains in court. The King County Sheriff had already decided in late June not to carry out the eviction, but Triangle reportedly took the county to court to force the action. Last Friday, the Bartons' front yard became the scene of a tense standoff between activists, King County Sheriffs, Seattle Police, and the emergency technicians driving an ambulance called to take Byron Barton to the Veterans Administration Hospital. Activists blocked the ambulance, and eventually the authorities left Barton on the sidewalk and retreated. By Monday, Mayor Murray met with the Bartons and afterward announced he was calling off the police until the couple's legal case is completed. He also announced that he had pledged Seattle's participation in the mayor's challenge to end veteran homelessness by 2015.
Also in Seattle, five tanker cars filled with crude from the Bakken oil fields derailed this morning. But none of the toxic material spilled, according to Burlington Northern Santa Fe officials. The train was loaded with 100 cars of crude headed toward the refinery on Anacortes Island. It derailed under the Magnolia Bridge, a bridge which was damaged in the 2001 Nisqually earthquake and is currently set for replacement. No one was injured in the derailment, and a hazardous material crew was on the scene within minutes, according to a BNSF spokesman. The accident comes as protesters were set to rally at a Seattle hearing regarding a new pier proposed by the BP Corporation for its Cherry Point refinery up near Bellingham. The Seattle City Council this week sent a letter to the United States Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox supporting environmental groups' petition for an emergency ban on shipments of Bakken and other highly flammable crude oil in old-style tankers known as DOT-111 cars. The tankers involved in the Seattle accident hold about 27,000 gallons of oil each, and they are a newer design with enhanced safeguards. Fawn Sharp, president of the Quinault Indian Nation, told the Associated Press that the accident could have caused an explosion that could have cost lives and could have contaminated Puget Sound.
Federal regulators announced that they would require railroads and oil shippers to use stronger tank cars to transport crude oil. The decision to phase out older cars is a response to the numerous derailments and spills involving oil trains this past year. The tank cars will now require thicker steel shielding, better thermal protection, and more crash-resistant valves. Cars that cannot be refitted with these materials will be retired or used to transport less hazardous cargo. The Transportation Department will also implement a wide range of measures aimed to improve oil train safety. These measures will reduce speed limits, help trains determine the safest route available, and notify emergency services about train traffic. All these changes are set to take place within the next 2 years.
Today, the Center for Economic and Policy Research unveiled a pay cut clock to show how much money minimum wage workers lose per second as their wage remains frozen at its current level. It's been 5 years to the day since the minimum wage was raised from $6.55 to $7.25. Inflation has reduced purchasing power since the wage was raised. In essence, this amounts to a continual pay cut for millions of workers. Every second, the pay cut clock updates the total cumulative amount that minimum wage workers have lost since the last raise back in 2009 to demonstrate the phenomenon. The clock was featured in today's press conference, which was held by Senator Tom Harkin, U.S. Representative George Miller, and U.S. Senator Al Franken in commemoration of the five-year anniversary.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
All right, so we have a minute to think.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Negotiations at the merged American Airlines are underway for 30,000 union workers. The airline merged with U.S. Airways in December. Union mechanics and related service workers at U.S. Airways have reached agreements. The efforts now underway are to achieve a joint collective bargaining agreement for the tens of thousands of employees at the new American Airlines. Both the American Postal Workers Union and the NAACP are in solidarity with the fast food worker Fight for 15 movement. Resolutions in support of the movement to raise fast food wages to a minimum of $15 an hour and to be able to form unions without employer retaliation were passed at the APWU and NAACP national conventions. The NAACP said promotion of economic justice for all is a cornerstone of the NAACP's mission. As Farm Labor Organizing Committee organizers work to sign up 5,000 new members among the tobacco fields of North Carolina, an international team of observers is in the state on a fact-finding mission. Ian Lavery and Jim Sheridan, two members of the British Parliament, are visiting the state to observe and document the working conditions of tobacco workers. U.S. Representative Marcy Kaptur will join the British Parliament members in their fact-finding visit. FLOC is pushing Reynolds American and British American tobacco companies to use their clout and control over the tobacco supply chain to improve the conditions of tobacco workers. FLOC President Baldemar Vasquez says that North Carolina tobacco workers endure low wages, high heat, camps with no windows, and a lack of sanitary places to bathe or do laundry. Workers also suffer from green tobacco sickness from their skin absorbing the tobacco as they work. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren has proposed allowing post offices to offer public banking services as a way to serve low-income people who don't have bank accounts. Chuck Zlatkin, assistant to the president of the American Postal Workers Union, says 59% of U.S. zip codes have one or no banks, and the working poor rely on predatory cash checking and lending operations.
There's a real social need for this to take place, and in every one of those zip codes, there are post offices. Post offices that have the infrastructure, that have trained personnel, that could provide service that would bring some necessary income to the Postal Service, but also really deal with this social need and give people what they public banking at a much less cost than they're paying now.
Several labor unions are endorsing the September 21st New York City People's Climate March. They include 1199 SEIU, AFSCME District Council 37, the New York State Nurses Association, the Connecticut State Council of Machinists, and transport unions, ATU and TWU. Other unions endorsing include Teamsters Joint Council 16, UAW Region 1A, IBEW Local 3, and SEIU 32BJ. The AFL-CIO hasn't yet taken a position on whether or not to endorse the climate march, but the Blue-Green Alliance, a coalition of environmental and labor groups, will participate in that September climate march. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Journalist Jeremy Scahill and The Intercept online magazine yesterday leaked the National Counterterrorism Center's watch listing guidance, the top secret rules for putting people on the national no-fly list. A federal judge in Portland ruled in June that the list was unconstitutional because it gives people listed on it no due process to have themselves removed. Attorneys at the City University of New York Law School and the Center for Constitutional Rights, who represent clients on the no-fly list, said yesterday the government's criteria for listing people is, quote, hopelessly vague and doesn't require any proof of an aviation threat. The lawyers claim that even basic civil disobedience anywhere in the world can get somebody added to the list, and that the list leaves their clients with the task of proving that they'll not engage in further or in future terrorist activity. The criteria for placement on the broader terrorist watch list, which grew by nearly 500,000 people in 2013 alone, are even lower. Social media postings, presumably including posts to Facebook and Twitter, can, by themselves, result in placement on a watch list, as can, quote, travel for no known lawful or legitimate purpose to a locus of terrorist activity, perhaps including entire countries such as Pakistan or Afghanistan. Read more on this at Scahill's expose, www.firstlook.org/The Intercept.
Iran has detained four journalists, three of whom are U.S. citizens. The Committee to Protect Journalists has called for the immediate release of the four journalists. A reporter for the Washington Post and his wife, who is a correspondent for a paper in the United Arab Emirates, were taken into custody along with two photographers. It is not clear why the journalists were arrested. The Committee to Protect Journalists says that Iran has a dismal record with regard to its treatment of imprisoned journalists. We hold the Iranian government responsible for the safety of these four. Iranian authorities have detained other international journalists in the past. Iran and China are the leading jailers of journalists in the world, with around 35 journalists in prison in each country.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, two female Finnish aid workers were killed in the western city of Herat today. They were riding in a taxi when they were shot to death by men on a motorcycle driving by. The taxi driver has been taken in for questioning, but the gunmen have so far not been found. This is the latest in a series of attacks on foreign aid workers, on journalists, and on civilians that has led to many foreign governments questioning their commitments in Afghanistan. The two women worked for the International Assistance Mission, an aid group that's been present in has been in Afghanistan since 1966 for 48 years, and which has received funding from Finland, Norway, and Sweden in the past. Now, those countries are questioning the safety of their citizens working in Afghanistan. Also, a bomb was exploded at a market in northern Takhar province, killing six people, including a young girl. The bombing was aimed at a police car, but the policeman escaped unharmed.
Music.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Henry Leisha, Ramona Frankhauser, and Lisa Loving. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Sean Stewart. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 90.9 FM. I'm Henry Leisha.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joe Uris, guest host, positively revolting talk radio. At 9, on One Land, Many Voices, co-hosts Ned Roche and Zaha Hassan look at the human costs of Israel's latest bombardment and ground invasion of occupied Gaza with guests Raji Surani and Mohammed Nabil. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on the Radio Zine, host Janka Soderberg gets an update on the latest deaths from Israeli bombings in Gaza with Mohammed Nabil, a Palestinian from Gaza who has been living in Portland for the past 2 years. At 11:20, Roberta Schwartz of Neighbors for a Livable West Lynn talks about saving the White Oak Savannah of the Willamette Valley and a summer concert for the White Oak Savannah this weekend. At 11:40, host Daniel Flessa speaks with Amy Conway and Erica Thomas of Dreamland Art Collective about a series of events that'll act as micro-examinations into how culture and technology are shifting the structure of relationships. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not yet a current member, you can become one easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for an interview with Allison Weir. If America knew about the continuing Israeli invasion of Gaza.
We are joined on the line now by Allison Weir of If Americans Knew and the Council for the National Interest Foundation. Your group has recently put together an infographic and background on the disproportionate violence between the Israelis and Palestinians. We've been hearing about the disproportionality over the last couple of weeks as more than 650 Palestinians have been killed and around 20 Israeli soldiers. But that disproportionality did not just begin with this operation. I wonder if you can take us back in time a little bit and talk about the disproportionality and the reasons for it between Israelis and Palestinians.
Sure, I'd be glad to. First of all, as you noted, this is the violence has been going on for a long time, and we find consistently a study by MIT showing that it is Israel that in just about every case is the one that first violated the calm when there have been various periods of calm and truces. It's Israel that has resumed violence first. But in terms of this year, the media are portraying this as an Israeli response to the three Israelis who were abducted back on, I believe it was June 8th. But in reality, the violence, of course, was already going on. We looked at the beginning of the year from January 1st through our study was to July 21st. And we found that approximately 30 Palestinians had already been killed in 2014 before any Israelis had been killed and before, actually one soldier had been killed. But before the three were abducted, 30 Palestinians had been killed. Four Palestinian children had been killed before these abductions. So, you know, that's in addition to that, while the media told a great deal and had a lot of news about these three young people who were abducted, and I don't think we still don't know who did it. We certainly know it was not an official Hamas action whatsoever. But during that same period of time, in fact, before that occurred, we found that over 2,000 Palestinians had been abducted by Israeli forces from their homes in the West Bank and Gaza. That it was actually 2,330 from January 1st through May 31st alone. During those same months, there was an average of 203 Palestinian children in Israeli jails on any given day. And in many cases, those children are not even charged with a crime. There's been no judicial process. They're just held in prison. Lawyers, it's very difficult for lawyers to visit them. It's extremely difficult even for parents to visit their children. So these abductions by Israeli forces are ongoing. They occur really almost every single day. When you look at the news from the Palestinian territories, every day more people have been abducted. But the U.S. media never tell about this. So they always begin, their version of the violence always begins with a Palestinian response, but they portray that as initiating the violence. Also, of course, the numbers killed are hugely disproportionate during this entire period. We found that during the period since this Israeli offensive began, that at the time we looked at it, 76% at least, and these are UN numbers, 76% of Palestinian deaths were civilians. Yeah, that's a very strong fact. This is not a war against Hamas. This is a war against the Gaza people. During that same period, some Israelis also were killed. We found that only 7% of those Israelis were civilians. You know, again, we find these Palestinian civilians being killed in huge numbers, abducted in huge numbers, injured in even larger numbers, and the media almost never discussing that aspect.
And what about the Israeli government's claim that the reason the civilian casualties are so high in Gaza is that Hamas is cynically placing women and children in harm's way? You yourself have been to Gaza. Do you find any credence to that claim?
No, not at all. And in fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was in Gaza. The first time I was in Gaza was in February and March of 2001. That was before any rocket fire had been launched from Gaza. Even according to the Israeli military, the first rockets from Gaza began in spring of 2001. There were only four that year. There were small homemade projectiles. I was there before that period. I went throughout Gaza. I found that Gaza and the West Bank, before these rockets were launched, were already being shelled by Israeli forces at that time nightly. There were entire residential neighborhoods in Gaza, especially I saw in Rafah, southernmost Gaza, and in Khan Yunis. There were entire neighborhoods that were completely bullet riddled. In some cases, there were buildings that held many Palestinian families that were completely destroyed in February and March of 2001, before the rockets were launched, and many years before Hamas was elected. So those are the two reasons that Israel gives for its violence, and yet I was there before Hamas and before rockets and saw massive Israeli violence against entire civilian neighborhoods.
What are the recourses that Palestinians have when this type of disproportionate violence is visited upon them?
There's very little recourse. You know, there are these strong accounts of Palestinians in Gaza. There's nowhere to go. You know, all of the places where they might take refuge now are crowded and overflowing. They usually cannot get out of Gaza. Israel controls the borders, and Gaza and the Egyptian government goes along with the U.S. and with Israel. So they're really held within this large open-air prison. In effect, you know, Israel partisans like to claim that the Israeli military is this wonderful moral fighting force. But in reality, it's just like shooting fish in a goldfish bowl, not even in a pond. You know, they have the people in a large open-air prison. They are launching tons of bombs on an extremely densely populated part of the world, in a place where most of the people are completely unarmed. There is some armed resistance. There are some groups that are launching rockets, trying to defend their population. It's enormously one-sided, disproportionate. Really doesn't even do justice to how massive the Israeli power is compared to the Gazan resistance forces' power.
You talked about the fact that Palestinians have no recourse and are unable to hold Israel accountable for its actions. And I wonder if you can talk about something that you mentioned in the piece on If Americans Knew, which is that there was a ceasefire offer made by Hamas. We've only been hearing in the U.S. media about a supposed ceasefire offer that was negotiated by Egypt, but apparently one of the parties, being Hamas, was never consulted on that ceasefire offer.
That's right. It's a bizarre situation. You know, again, this is not the way ceasefires are negotiated. The two parties negotiate it. And we don't have somebody just negotiating it with one party and then handing it to the other party. And, you know, the international media claiming that's a ceasefire that would be an authentic attempt at peace. The fact is that Hamas for many years has been offering ceasefires and has actually ceased its own fire for long periods of time. For many years, they've been offering Israel a long-term ceasefire. They ask minimal conditions in return, that this really illegal siege, in which the people who suffer most in any siege, of course, are the young and the old and anybody who's sick. So the siege against the Gaza would need to be removed. There are a number of reasonable conditions that Hamas is asking for. But again, we never hear about that. Our media consistently give us the Israeli version of what's actually going on.
And, of course, the siege on Gaza has played a significant role in the situation that people there are finding themselves in now. Many people have become desperate in a situation where there is no economy left. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the siege.
That's right. I was there a few years ago after the largest previous massacre that took place. I think it was around 2009. And I was there about a year after that. Normally, Palestinians are amazingly quick at rebuilding their towns and cities after Israel has destroyed them. I guess they're used to needing to do that. And, you know, they rebuild with astonishing rapidity in many cases. In this case, they were still unable to build the thousands of homes, the numerous hospitals and schools that had been destroyed, because Israel was preventing building materials from going in. I talked to a doctor from Gaza who told me that the operating supplies in just the normal operating room were extremely deficient. There wasn't enough anesthetic to give people anesthesia if they just needed to undergo a typical operation. There wasn't enough film for x-rays. Many, many medications, very significant medicines, are under-supplied there, if they're even there at all. So for many years, Israel has blocked major types of supplies to the entire population living in Gaza. It's an enormous degree of suffering that's truly horrifying to see in today's day and age, when, you know, we do see, you know, tragic malnutrition in some parts of the world, or famine, or, you know, often resulting from some sort of natural disaster. In this case, it is a humanly imposed disaster on an entire population. You know, where infants are suffering in pain. Often there's some treatable sickness that they have that causes excruciating pain, and yet they're not allowed to reach the kind of medical care that they need. They don't have the kind of medicines that would cure them or would prevent these things from happening. You know, there's a level of cruelty that's going on that's really almost impossible to fathom, except that it has gone on year after year after year. There are cases where, you know, on a different kind of level, Israeli forces not too long ago, often they shoot someone, usually a young person, a young man in many cases, is shot, lies there in agony, bleeding in front of people, and Israeli forces prevent any kind of medical care reaching that person. You know, and they bleed to death right in front of their families in many cases. You know, that is an outright war crime. And it doesn't happen just once or twice. You know, I've been reading reports of that going on year after year. Even when it's not this major massacre that's in the news to a degree, this happens other times. You know, Israel kills people many times, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. But, you know, it's only one or two at a time, and our media usually don't even report those.
And just want to get, before the end of this, to what Americans can do. I know you're part of the Stop the Blank Check campaign, which is meant to end U.S. aid to Israel. What do you think that Americans can do? And will it make a difference in Washington, where 100% of the senators and 100% of the congressmen recently voted to support the U.S. the Israeli invasion of Gaza?
Well, it is amazing. It shows the power of the Israel lobby, because the American population is increasingly waking up. I think there are large numbers of people across the political spectrum. They're extremely outraged at what Israel is doing and are trying to stop it. But right now in Washington, the lobby and AIPAC and all of the various entities of the Israel lobby are still so powerful that the Senate, as you said, the Senate Appropriations Committee just voted an additional $620 million to go to Israel on top of this over $3 billion that they already get. When we look at the numbers that, you know, it looks like will be enacted, it's now going to be close to $10 million per day of U.S. money to Israel. And this is being passed in the middle of a massacre, where even somebody who's very, very neutral and feels that both parties are equal can see, you know, that huge numbers of Gaza civilians are being killed, and yet this passed. What I feel is happening, though, and will make a difference, is that senators are getting a great number of phone calls, for once, from people asking them, telling them that they want the Senate to stop our money to Israel, that they want our senators to get up on the Senate floor and call on Israel to stop its massacre. Now, senators often receive phone calls and donations and threats and bribes from the pro-Israel partisans around the country, of whom, by the way, it's a tiny, tiny proportion of our population. It's, you know, at most, probably, you know, let's say 2%. But they get calls from them all the time. What is different this time is apparently they are getting large numbers of phone calls from people calling their senators, telling their senators to call on Israel to stop the slaughter of Gazans and to stop sending our money to Israel. And I think those phone calls and the demonstrations, especially